Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melvin Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Are You at Risk, the podcast about legal malpractice and other crazy things that often go wrong in a law practice. I'm Todd Scott, the Vice President of Risk Management at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual. And with me are two of my absolute favorite colleagues, Kiernan Waters.
Hi.
And Joy Melvin Griffin.
Hello, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, you guys. Okay, so I have a story to tell.
Oh, I love story time.
Let's get into it.
So sit back, get your popcorn, prepare your favorite caffeinated beverage, and listen to this. This is about conflicts of interest. And actually, this story kind of hit the news at a time when I was teaching in law school quite a bit. And actually, even though I teach about legal systems, I found myself having to explain to young law students and other people that were studying to work in the law about what conflict checking was and why these systems are so important. And but this story hit the news and I'm like, okay, this is pretty good. This is about two people who are very, very wealthy and they were married. And the husband's name is Frank McCourt and his wife's name is Jamie McCourt. And okay, Frank had gobs of money. He's originally from New Hampshire or Massachusetts or something like that. I don't know if that's really pertinent to this situation, but they had lots and lots of money. And in fact, Frank was so wealthy, some people might recognize him because he was the former owner of the LA Dodgers.
And, ooh la la.
So
yeah, seems like those Cali teams are having problems with management, but go ahead.
This is more about problems with marriage management. And as you can tell, I mean, they're married and we wouldn't be talking about this in a malpractice podcast if something horrible didn't go wrong. So, but in this case, okay, so they're married and Frank does something that I know wouldn't go over very well in my household. But he comes home one day and says to his wife, I think we ought to get an antenuptial agreement. And that's like a prenuptial agreement, but it's after you got married. Mm-hmm. And it's one of these agreements that says, hey, what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. So first of all, I mean, all right, wouldn't this kind of set off some
alarm bells, some red flags?
Yeah.
So anyway, well, I know my wife would not be happy if I came home with this idea and she'd probably lawyer up pretty quick. But in this case, Frank says, hey, let's get an antenuptial agreement. Well, he's saying it's because of the Dodgers. And, you know, the other owners are concerned, you know, if something were to go wrong, you know, that we want to just at least make it clear that Frank owns the Dodgers. And, okay, so Jamie's understands this, makes sense. And Frank's like, I'll just get my lawyer to put this together. And there's an LA lawyer named Larry Silverstein who put together this antenuptial agreement. So now he's representing both the husband and the wife. To put together this document.
What?
There's the telltale O's and the
They had enough money to hire every attorney in California and they couldn't even hire more than one.
So you can see where this is going. Yes, of course. But I don't know. Maybe that's how you get extremely filthy rich.
I'm so sorry. At what point did Jamie not say, lawyers, why can't this just be drafted in the partnership agreement? I'm so confused.
Mm-hmm. See, Joy's husband wouldn't even get through the door to make it.
No, the rule in my house is what's yours is yours and what's yours is mine. But go ahead.
I should have had a show of hands. Who here in this conversation has a prenuptial agreement or antenuptial agreement? So I'm just teasing. I don't know. I think I've always thought of this as a rich person thing, but who knows?
Joy and I have so much law school debt. We really didn't want a prenup because we want our husbands to share in that.
Yeah.
My law school debt, okay?
What's yours is mine, except for your debt. So, okay. So, all right, you guys are onto it. This is sounding weird. Okay. But this guy Silverstein, you know, hey, he's going to make some money off of this. So he's putting together this pretty significant agreement, you know, and supposedly the relationship is going pretty well. So he puts together and he makes 5 copies and he has a signing and husband and wife, along with whoever's there to witness it and notarize it, they proceed to finalize and sign and endorse 5 copies. This is all part of the record. All right, so he collects this. Okay, fast forward a couple years. Frank does something else that wouldn't go over very well in my house if I were to have succeeded in coming home and saying, hey, honey, let's get anti-nuptial agreements. Frank comes home and says, or he's looking through the agreement and he notices that Silverstein made a mistake.
Mm-mm.
And on the ledger, on the attachments, that says whose property is who, belongs to who, he notices that the LA Dodgers, the whole reason they did this is it says it belongs, you know, to the couple. It's not exclusive of the marriage. It's inclusive to the marriage. So it's a one-word off situation. So, so he comes home again and says, hey, honey, we got to make new copies of the anti-nuptial agreement. Should I pause for more comments and thoughts?
I'd be running off to the divorce attorney going before the update was made.
It's like, hey, what's he going through there reading, this
if
in detail?
If he had been this thorough before the wedding had actually happened, he would have avoided all this. If he had thought, hey, let's do a prenuptial agreement, which is, you know, the right timing for that. If they had both hired their own separate attorneys to do that, and if they had kept all those properties and whatnot. So yeah. He had a lot of thought put into this just way too late.
Well, so, I guess the malpractice side of me is like, was this ever put in writing as these are my requests? This is what I need as far as the, what is going to be in this anti-nuptial agreement.
Because subpoena that fire, Joy. We need the notes.
Oh, God. Help me.
Okay, so believe it or not, the story gets worse.
No.
So they gather again. They ask for 5 copies back. They produce 5 new copies. And they're signed and endorsed and notarized. And they end up in the appropriate files and delivered to the appropriate people. And like I said, we wouldn't be talking about this at a malpractice podcast unless the marriage completely fell apart and it's all the lawyer's fault, which is what happened. So but at least Frank's thinking, at least I got that darn antinuptial fixed. But Jamie says, hey, buddy, not so fast. I have an original copy of the first agreement.
I was going to say 5 copies is a lot of copies to have around, or 5 originals. I'm sorry, 5 originals is a lot of originals to keep track of.
So are you saying that the second copy did not have any revocation language in it?
It did. But you have 2 copies. Well, number one, somebody working for Silverstein didn't do their job right. They didn't collect all 5 copies. So they just kind of ignored the fact that Jamie still hung on to the first copy.
I wonder if she actually lied and hid it. And she was, oh, I never saw an original. Is there? Oh, it's not in that drawer. You know, like, or if she was just, if it was just missing.
You're going to like this. I'll cut to the chase on one part of it. Guess what Jamie did for a living? She was an attorney.
Stop.
So, yeah. How
did she not know better?
No, she knew. Well, don't you think? I mean,
she went along with the anti-nuptial. I would have thought that law degree would have made that discussion more, a lot more animosity there.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting one. I guess we'll never know why she decided to go along with this whole thing.
Maybe
and
the first
to
request included a new Ferrari or something,
who knows what was promised that month that made it worthwhile. But think about it. If you are Larry Silverstein, you are totally hosed Because now, no matter how this turns out, you know, you've got this, you've got two anti-nuptial agreements that's out there. Everything's going to go to court. And you've represented both of these people. So one of these two parties is going to sue the hell out of you. That's for sure. And it's going to be big stakes. So, and the ownership of the LA Dodgers is on the line.
Yeah. Oh, so, my gosh.
Whoa. Yeah. So Larry can't afford to buy out all the other partners. This asset is just way too huge. And so if this asset is owned jointly, what he's got to do then is sell his portion of the ownership, and then the proceeds of that sale become the part of the marital property that need to be distributed equitably. This is in California, by the way. So there's a lot on the line, and this dragged on for a lot of years. Well, and if you were an LA Dodgers fan, it was driving you nuts, apparently. Occasionally, when I'm talking, using this as an example to talk about conflicts of interest, especially in front of students, there's usually one really sharp baseball fan in the group who goes, I remember this, because they were on pins and needles waiting for this thing to get sorted out as to who owned the LA Dodgers. Oh. So McCourt could get out from under this situation, and then the Dodgers could be healthy financially again and maybe start drafting some really good players. So it really took a long time. But in the end, the judge found that the original document was upheld. And Jamie's, the one she hung on to, was the deciding factor. And
good
so,
for her.
Yeah. way to go, Jamie. So,
do you know what the detail was? Like, how did they come to that conclusion?
Yeah, like.
And I apologize. It's been so long. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go look it up, but to find out, you know, what it was about those documents that. And how at least the second one was processed, that her and her lawyer, her new lawyer, were able to argue that, you know, this second one doesn't hold. It was botched. And so therefore, and I still have an original of the first one. And so the LA Dodgers belongs to both me and Frank. And so anyway, yeah, lots and lots of money involved.
So I'm assuming that's how they got Kershaw finally, once they resolved all the issues.
Joy, much more of a baseball fan, MLB fan than I am.
It's my grandma's favorite team.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe that's it. We'll have to find out. We'll do a postscript on this someday. But this, you know, okay, so I like talking to law students, especially about this story, because, well, number one, let's just talk about the systems. What could have been done differently in Silverstein's firm to prevent this whole thing from blowing up?
Well, the fact that they, as a couple, used one attorney, I mean, mm-hmm. each should be represented. I mean, I'm assuming, I haven't done any anti-nuptials, but I've done a handful of prenuptials. And the idea is that each person in the, you know, in the upcoming marriage, right, needs to be represented by a different attorney. Each attorney has to have their own individual client's best interests at heart in terms of the negotiating of the division of assets. So even in an anti-nuptial agreement, I mean, I can't fathom that there's a situation that would allow one attorney to represent both sides of this couple, talking about, you know, commingled assets and individual assets that they would have come into the marriage with. So the idea that she was an attorney and didn't seek out her own counsel to represent her interests is crazy to me. And an attorney who would take on a couple like this?
Right.
And what attorney would hire a couple? I mean, talk about being in the middle of, you know, an argument. It just seems like a really bad position to even find oneself in. But as an attorney, you should know that, you know, not even another attorney at your firm, but another attorney altogether somewhere else needed to step in and be a part of this discussion.
At some point in time, Silverstein needed to be able to tell them. He should have said, hey, listen, you need to seek independent counsel. He should have put that in writing. But, I mean, to his point, maybe there could be an argument depending upon, and I'm not too familiar with the law in California as it relates to being able to bring out that attorney's Jamie. I mean, her skill, knowledge, and experience in law to say, hey, she should be held to a higher standard, like Kiernan said. You know, why, if she's so experienced as an attorney, did she not seek legal counsel? And I don't know, maybe that could have taken down some of the damages. I'm really interested to see how much of a sanction this was.
Well, even if they both, I mean, thinking it through, even if they both agreed, the parties to the antinuptial agreed on hiring one attorney, the next step would be to put something in writing that, hey, we both are aware of the situation and the conflict of interest here by being, you know, two people represented by this one attorney and talking about an antinuptial agreement. Silverstein should have, you know, put something in writing to protect himself in this situation as well when all these factors are coming to play. So even if they thought, hey, yeah, this is a great idea, let's do it this way, they still should have thought, hey, let's memorialize this and do it, you know, as our rules of professional responsibility dictate, and, you know, have it made aware, signed, you know, in writing, all that good stuff to come above the rules that we have.
But Todd, I don't always see that in family law. You know, another big time that I see this, another frequent time I should say, is in criminal law. Why are we representing not just the husband and wife? Why are we also representing co-conspirators? Yeah. What? Where do we do that? You can't. It's inevitable, right? That one party is going to have a difference of opinion in something than the other party. And we have to prepare for that. And you just cannot adequately represent both when it's going to happen.
Yeah. I used to find myself having to draw these big circles on the whiteboard for the students, because sometimes they'll think of things purely as an ethics concern, but then not think anything about the negligence factor. And so I finally started drawing these concentric circles. I think that's the right term. I wasn't good at geometry, but it was a circle where two circles were part of them overlap.
Yeah.
And so in one circle, it was ethics. In the other circle, it was malpractice. And where they overlap, I mean, and I explained to them, look, there are things that can get you in trouble purely in the ethics world, but you're not going to get sued for it. And then there are things that can get you... You're going to have liability, but the lawyers board isn't going to care because you screwed something up. As a result, it didn't get to court on time, and now somebody has damages and they have a liability case against you. But it's not unless it involves certain circumstances, that doesn't automatically mean you're going to lose your license or anything like that. But there's this in between where there is a category of things that will get you in trouble in both worlds. And conflicts of interest is usually one of the biggest things in that area where these things can happen. And so the whole point is, if it's one of the reasons why we spend a lot of time talking about ethics concerns, because if you know the rules and you know how to properly, you know, waive conflicts of interest and, you know, talk to the clients about whether the representation is directly adverse to what they're doing. And, you know, and if a client gives informed consent in writing, then you can do that. And then by doing that, you're likely to avoid a malpractice thing that could come up later as well. So, but Joy, you mentioned, you know, criminal, there's so many circumstances where it can come up, you know, representing two people who've been involved in a car accident where they're both passengers of the same car. Husband and wife, where they're both injured in the same car, but a lawyer can do that. But then that's the other thing too, where at some point the representation for these two individuals can be directly adverse to each other.
Especially there's if one only is a one, driver.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And there's not enough insurance money. Mm-hmm. And the husband is, for his brain injury, is getting more money than the wife for her neck injury, you know, and they're both, even though they're married and they're not adversarial, well, beyond the ordinary husband and wife stuff, that they could technically they're adversarial because they're fighting over the same pot of money. So lawyers need to recognize this stuff too. I don't know. What do you say to people when they ask you, hey, this, do I have a conflict of interest here? Or how do I proceed?
I'll give you a scenario of one attorney who asked me if he had a conflict of interest. Strap in, hold on tight, guys. You ready?
Let's hear it.
He formed a relationship with an opposing client. A spicy relationship. This had red pepper flakes all on it.
Wait, so let's get this straight. He, opposing client, not opposing counsel,
no.
Opposing client.
Opposing client. Okay. So this was a civil matter.
This is really enemies to lovers.
And so it was someone who was brought in as a third party defendant. So they came in later in the litigation. I mean, well, not that much later, but, you know, a little bit later than the commencement, right? And I think it was like love at first sight at the deposition or something. It was
love
like,
at first scheduling conference.
Exactly. And so, you know, there were emails where they were, you know, he was like, hey, can I meet to discuss with you? And of course, that's the first rule, right? She's represented by counsel. Why did you need to talk to her and not the counsel? So there were some other ethical issues. But at the end of it, and of course, he did not tell us, you know, that the emails were there and all that other stuff before. But at the end of the representation, after the case had been closed, he says, hey, I want to start up this relationship. Do I have a conflict? I was like, first of all, are you still in your appeal period? Oh, I was the wrong person to ask. So anyway, I was like, okay, is the order been finalized, number one? Because in many instances, you know, you've got a 20-day, a 30-day, 60-day appellate right, obviously. And then, you know, as he's talking more, I'm finding out a little bit more, hey, no, this had started way back when. I was like, you don't need me, you need prayer, because I think this ship is sinking. And sure
hang
enough,
up and call
you know,
God.
So you know what happened after that? I mean, he was reported. The young lady took it to social media, thinking that everything was okay because the case was over with, and the original opposing counsel, did their due diligence and went to the bar on that attorney.
Wow.
You know, in our world of malpractice, that reminds me, Joy, of your story. There are the things that maybe aren't technically conflict of interest. Like, let's say the case was over. Mm-hmm. And then he strikes it up with the hottie on the other side of the conference room table. But, in off hours. But there are the things that are the perception of a conflict of interest where your client is going to question your loyalty, even though it may be allowed. I'll give you an example. A case where lawyers representing husband and wife in a divorce. Representing the wife in a divorce. She finds out, 8 months into the thing, after they've been going full force ahead, 8 months into the thing, that her soon-to-be ex-husband is dating the gal who sits at the reception desk at the firm that she hired. She's pissed as hell at the firm, like they should have figured this out. Wait, my husband's sleeping with your damn receptionist, and you're working on my divorce?
That's sriracha right there.
How did that even happen?
Yeah. So it's a small town. That's part of it too. I have a lot of fun when we're talking to students about this too. Who here is from, raise your hand if you're from a town under 5,000 people, and I'm in the Midwest. So in these law school classes, there'll still be a half a dozen hands that'll go up. Okay, under 2,500, still two or three hands. Under 1,500 and one hand goes up. But you talk to those people and it's like, okay, everybody in those towns knows what the hell's going on with everybody else, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's this, managing conflicts of interest, especially in these small locations, is really, really hard. So you always got to have these talks with the client. But then the other thing is training the staff. And so in that case, that was a process issue, which, you know, it's one thing if you're representing a wife in a divorce, you would check your systems to find out, have we ever represented the husband in the past and things like that. But the other step to the process is to communicate with the firm and say, we are about to represent Hillary Clinton in her divorce to husband William James Clinton. Does anybody in the firm know any reason why we may have a conflict of interest regarding the representation
of
this client?
That comes down to frequent communications within the firm too, you know?
Yep.
Yep, exactly. There's always the 1-2 when you're checking for conflicts. You check your database to find out if we have any sort of involvement with these parties in the past where we are either directly or indirectly conflicted out. And then once you find out that information, you can make assessments about, is this a waivable conflict or not? Things like that. How long ago did we represent this person? How long ago did we sue this person? But then if you send out that other thing too, that's when somebody might knock on your door. Hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And close the door behind them and say, I've been sleeping with her ex-husband. You know, you'll find out all kinds of things like that if you do it right.
Or if you see him at a water cooler, but go ahead.
Yeah.
And that's especially important when you're bringing on new hires or merging with another firm, right? You want to have that conflicts check.
Oh.
If you're bringing on a new attorney and say, hey, who have you worked with in the past that we need to kind of be thinking about moving forward? So that's a really great time to do a conflicts check. Of course, you should be keeping a list of all your clients and, you know, looking at it anytime you have a new client. But there's a few times where you need to be checking for these conflicts and being kept apprised and aware of your staff and changes and all that good stuff.
But Todd, take Kiernan's point. What if you got a new hire? What do you say? Hey, can I ask you, who have you been sleeping with lately?
HR is going to say, don't ask that. Unless you want an ethics complaint. But
exactly.
But yeah,
what
list,
exactly.
A list. And you know, these systems to do the conflicts check, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, I think a lot of people think, oh gosh, I need a whole, you know, technological system and have to do all these bells and whistles. It can be really simple, right? I mean, it could be like an Excel spreadsheet that just you're keeping a list of all the people's names, and then you can do your little search function and see if it comes up. I mean, there's certainly more to it than that, but you don't have to overthink it necessarily just to have something good in place to be keeping apprised of any potential conflicts.
You know, that's a good point. And that's frankly how my job got started so long ago, is our underwriters were asking our people, lawyers applying for insurance, you know, what do you use for conflict checking? Do you use any systems? And they're like, I don't use anything. Do you have any suggestions? And then they would say, well, hold on, we'll connect you to the lawyer in the claims department that knew a little bit about technology. That was me.
Yeah.
And so I found myself, you know, explaining to these policyholders how to set up a good conflict check system. You didn't have to buy a huge mega database. You can create your own just using an Excel spreadsheet, things like that. I think nowadays it doesn't make sense to not use a case management program. There's a lot of good cloud-based ones that will help you just put all those names in there. And then that way I can do a search and say, look, Hillary is about to hire us. I'll stop using Bill and Hillary's example. I'll use, I always like to use Tony Soprano and his wife, Carmella. I don't know if you were a Sopranos fan, but there's another example too. So there was an episode where Tony went around to all the best divorce lawyers in New Jersey and had like a 5-minute conversation with them. Well, I'm thinking of getting a divorce.
And we know why he did
really?
That.
And then they start talking about the Mets and stuff like that. And that was it. He was gone. And then a year later, when Carmella's coming in to look for a divorce lawyer, they're like, look, I can't tell you why, but I can't represent.
Conflicted out.
Because of that one that one conversation, they can't even tell Carmella that your husband was here a year ago looking for a potential divorce lawyer too. So, so that's another reason why you hang on to those names, even of prospective clients. Yeah. I don't think you're going to forget if Tony Soprano was sitting in your office, but you might forget if Jim Schnickelfritz was there talking about divorcing his wife or any other rando. So that's why we use those systems.
A couple of points, though. Ty, I think I love what you just said, and I just want to make sure our listeners really pick up on this. I would avoid stating exactly what your conflict is, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to get into now attorney-client privileged information. If you feel that you have a conflict and you have to notify the potential client of it, you need to be as broad as possible, just like Todd said. I can't tell you exactly why, but I have a conflict. Telling too much could violate our model rules of professional conduct. And another thing I wanted to make sure that we, you know, just kind of touched on is that when you have these, if you don't have the case management system and you're putting it to Excel or whatnot, it's not enough just to put the person's name in that came for the consultation. If there are other interested big parties, if this was case of the McCourts, you know, and now we have someone else for the Dodgers, that could establish right there or create a conflict of interest. So you want to make sure those names have been captured as well. So when you do your conflict search, that will come up.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't even touched on conflicts involving business transactions. Oh. That probably deserves its special conversation because we've all seen those things where one person, one lawyer is making the deal for the group. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, nobody knows who exactly that lawyer was representing. So we'll maybe save that for a future podcast discussion because there's a lot to be said just about those conflicts alone.
I'm surprised that we even had, you know, this much to talk about considering at MLM, you know, we don't face conflict of interest claims that often. And there's a really great reason for that. And in fact, Todd, you mentioned it just a few minutes ago. It's because our underwriters verify that all of our policyholders and new business applicants have them confirm that they use a conflict checked system. And so we're only going to give you a policy or renew your policy if you're confirming for us that you are, doing conflict checks on a regular basis and have a conflict check system in place. And because of that, we see very, very few claims regarding conflicts of interest, whereas it's a major source of claims for other major carriers and really for the whole lawyer's professional liability industry. Conflicts of interest are always ranking really high on like the top 10, you know, claims that are seen in the industry, but not for us because we verify that. And that really shows the importance of that conflict check.
That's a great point. And I guess I'd be remiss if we wrapped up and I didn't mention where you can, you're never too old to study these rules very carefully. There's a lot of them because there's so many different ways you could have conflicts of interest. But in the ABA model rules, it's 1.7 conflicts of interest, current clients, 1.8 conflict of interest, current clients, specific rules. That's where you really get into the good stuff. Some of those examples that Joy was talking about earlier. 1.9, duties to former clients. 1.10, imputation of conflicts of interest. That's if somebody joins your firm.
There you go.
And they come like Typhoid Mary bringing all those conflicts with them. Does that conflict out your firm and all that? 1.11, special conflicts of interest involving, you know, government employees and officers. Those are the people who used to throw people in jail and now they're working for my firm. Are they conflicted out of every person they threw in jail? Things like that. To me, 1.18 is the one that always kind of freaks out lawyers too. And that's the conflicts of interest involving prospective clients. People that never gave you a dime, you might owe a duty of confidentiality to because you started up, you initiated an attorney-client relationship. Might have even been something online as well. So anyway, lots of things to check out there and to avoid this very, very nasty problem. Any final thoughts, you guys?
Try not to fall for opposing clients. That's probably my biggest.
But Joy, what if she's the love of your life and all of a sudden heaven is sitting there right in front of you?
I definitely want to wait. if she's the love of your life, hopefully your life will extend past the case and that you can have your forever relationship after, but not a second before. But most importantly, you know, just do your due diligence with your conflicts checks. It will save you a lot in the long run.
Absolutely. I second what Joy said.
Terrific. Well, I think that's it for this one. Thank you, guys. Thanks to everybody else for joining us for this podcast. We hope you're enjoying it and check out our next one.
Bye.
See you later.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melvin Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlmins.com. That's mlmins.com.